no. Hang on.
This is not a good
All right, cool.
Yes, fine.
Ready?
Welcome to the bite-size edition of the Editor Roundtable podcast. Here on the Roundtable, we're dedicated to helping you become a better writer, following the StoryGrid method developed by Sean Coyne. In these episodes, we bring you some shorter articles and interviews on topics that interest us as writers. Hi, I'm Leslie Watts.
And I'm Anne Hawley, and today we're bringing you Essential Action.
Essential Action is an important tool to help you evaluate your scenes simply by tracking what your characters want. So join us for a quick bite of writing insight starting right now. After each scene in Pride and Prejudice, the StoryGrid edition, Sean Coyne poses four specific questions to help writers determine whether a story event occurs within the scene. The first two are, what is literally happening in the scene? And what is the essential action of what the characters are doing in the scene? Our StoryGrid investigation team is on the case, and today we'll show you what you need to know to evaluate the conflict in your scenes and ensure they support a story event that works. It all starts with knowing what the point of view character wants, also known as the essential action.
When we say that in order for your scene to work, you must have a story event, you probably wouldn't be surprised. And it doesn't sound too difficult. So long as something is happening, you have a story event, right? Not necessarily. A story event is specific, not just something that happens. It's an active change in life value for one or more of the characters as a result of conflict. What's more, the life value change and conflict within the scene must be specific too. Even if you nail your global genre and have included all the appropriate obligatory scenes and conventions, your story could still flounder if you don't pay attention to these scene elements. Valerie Francis, one of our fellow StoryGrid editors, has tackled life value changes in a Fundamental Fridays post, which we will link to in the show notes. Now, literal action is pretty straightforward. You simply say what you observe. The characters might be having a conversation over lunch, practicing Wudan swords dances, or hiding from velociraptors.
But what is the essential action? The term doesn't even appear in the StoryGrid book. Well, it is the point of view character's goal in the scene. In other words, what they want. The inciting incident within a scene upsets the status quo, causing a desire to arise within one or more characters. From that desire comes a goal, and that goal is the character's essential action, which should be connected to the character's goal for the entire story. So, if the literal action is what's happening on the surface, then the essential action is what's happening below the surface or the subtext within the scene. So the essential action in the scene should be condensed down to a short, wide-open phrase or a highly specific single verb that relates to the global objects of desire. But that's kind of confusing, so let's look at an example. Our masterwork for this article is the 1993 film, The Fugitive. Harrison Ford plays Richard Kimball, the fugitive, and Tommy Lee Jones is Sam Gerard, the federal marshal pursuing him. Gerard enters a culvert full of rushing water, loses his footing. His gun flies out of his hand, and he slides down the culvert. Then he scrambles to his feet, only to discover that, oh no, his missing gun is in Kimball's hand, pointed at Gerard.
I didn't kill my wife! I don't care!
So, to analyze this scene, what is Richard Kimball, the fugitive, literally doing?
Well, and he's holding a gun on a federal marshal.
Never a good plan.
No.
What is Gerard literally doing?
He has lost his gun to the fugitive, which also is not a very good thing.
Whoops.
So what is Kimball's essential action then?
And here's where we get into the interesting verbs. He is imploring the marshal, begging him for the chance to prove his innocence.
Okay, and then what is Gerard's essential action?
And more interesting verbs here. He is disregarding what the fugitive says to him. He might even be mocking him.
Okay, so let's look more closely at Gerard's essential action. If you watch the whole movie, which we enthusiastically recommend, you'll see that Gerard is expressing the same type of essential action tactics toward Richard Kimball in scene after scene. You might describe this as outwit, capture, stop. Throughout the middle build, Gerard's object of desire, that is his want, is to bring the fugitive in. He tries several different tactics, and every time Kimball thwarts him, he is forced to question his wants a little more until, snap, at his all-is-lost moment, he understands that Kimball really is innocent. Then his object of desire shifts from his want to his need. Now, his need, which is it's always been operating, is to see justice done. His definition has changed to saving an innocent man at a pivotal turning point in his story, and the scene-by-scene essential action will change with it. Because he still needs his position as the guy who brings in fugitives, and he can't afford to lose his job or his reputation, he doesn't suddenly switch. He finesses it. Gerard's essential action becomes something like cover, conceal, play both sides of the street until real justice, that is, Kimball's exoneration, is apparent to everyone, and Gerard's role as a righteous man of justice is safe. So the nature of the essential actions in your scenes should not shift at a random time or in a haphazard way.
Generally speaking, randomness and haphazardness are not advisable in stories. So let's take a look at Kimball's essential action. Richard Kimball's arc is a bit more complex than Gerard's because he's the protagonist, but up until the confrontation in the tunnel, he's simply hoping that truth will prevail and justice will be done. His understanding shifts when he tells Gerard of his innocence, and the federal marshal says, "I don't care." Kimball realizes that the only way to save himself and obtain justice is to evade this relentless hunter long enough to uncover truth using his best skills. This is where he accepts the hero's call to action in the hero's journey terminology. His essential action after that is to get someone to see a bigger picture. To do that, he has to outrun, outwit, and investigate. Those are those key verbs. Until his true need, which is he's a doctor, right? To help, to heal, to throw someone a lifeline, comes to the fore at the hospital, and he jeopardizes his escape from Gerard by saving a little boy's life. Now, the casual reader or moviegoer probably can't say what the character's essential action is in a particular scene. But when you feel like you're witnessing great acting on the screen or great characterization on the page, look closer and you'll be able to detect it. The actor or the author knows why the character is doing what they're doing.
So where does essential action come from? Well, it all started with actors. If you Google essential action, you'll notice that the results come from places like acting schools, theater courses, and blogs about the actor's craft. The concept comes from an acting approach called practical aesthetics, developed by David Mamet and William H. Macy. Practical aesthetics teaches actors to break a scene down in steps that include the literal action and the essential action, much like we suggest you do to find the story event in your scenes. But you don't have to invent the phrases to describe the essential action. Actors have already done that for you. Followers of practical aesthetics have come up with lists of essential actions, and I've compiled them in one handy essential action cheat sheet, which you can find in the show notes. I'm going to share 11 of these with you that we use pretty frequently, and you can also find these embedded in Anne's giant novel spreadsheet template, which is also linked in the show notes. So here are the essential action phrases: to get someone on my team, to lay down the law, to draw the dividing line, to get someone to take a big risk, to get my due or retrieve what's rightfully mine, to get someone to see the big picture, to enlighten someone to a higher understanding, to tell a simple story, to get to the bottom of something, to close the deal, and to get someone to throw me a lifeline.
I know you really like that, to get to the bottom of something one, and I'm very fond of to enlighten someone to a higher understanding, just generally in my life.
Yes.
So let's take a look at some of those essential action single verbs that I discovered. In a book called Actions, The Actor's Thesaurus, which is written by Maria Calderon and Maggie Lloyd-Williams, you will find 150 pages of one-word essential actions, which an actor might use in deciding how to play a line of dialogue. They're all transitive verbs, that is, verbs that make sense when placed between I and you to form a complete sentence. For example, I charm you, I defeat you, I encourage you, I stun you. Any writer should consider getting hold of a copy of this book. It is a treasure. It will be subtextual, not stated, but if you leaf through Actions, The Actor's Thesaurus, or pour over our list of essential actions, you'll probably find the right words to describe the essential action in your scene. It's a great way to begin really making this valuable tool your own. You may be thinking, but I'm not an actor, I'm a writer. Yeah, you are. These phrases and verbs that are so useful to actors are equally valuable for writers who are trying to strengthen character action and tell a better story. So though you may not be an actor, thinking of your characters as actors and yourself as their writer, director, creator god can make your scenes and therefore your story stronger. When you make deliberate choices consistent with the global objects of desire and tell your characters precisely what to say and do, their behavior will make artistic sense. Now, if you're the kind of writer who ordinarily lets your characters tell you who they are and how they want to behave, this might sound like blasphemy, but stick with us. We have more to show you.
Yes, and we want to send you into cognitive dissonance. Let's say you've worked through your scenes and they all abide by the five commandments of storytelling, but some of them still fall flat. Maybe your characters aren't convincing or readers don't connect with them. You might receive feedback like, I don't believe she'd do that here. Or, why did he make that choice? Or, this character feels two-dimensional. Your reader may be sensing that you've failed to make a consistent, conscious choice about your character's actions. When what the character does doesn't jibe with what they seem to want and need, the reader goes, huh? That doesn't make any sense. When that happens, the reader is experiencing cognitive dissonance. Cognitive dissonance is that mental discomfort triggered by a situation when a person's belief clashes with new information. And here's an example. Several years ago, I went to the Flagstaff Nature Center in Boulder, Colorado, where taxidermic examples of the local wildlife were on display. One was a mountain lion, and I noticed right away that it was a little off. Its head, its fur, and its markings all appeared to be normal, but something wasn't quite right. I couldn't put my finger on it, but it bothered me. That lion created cognitive dissonance. Now, in trying to get to the bottom of this, I mentioned my confusion to a staff member who explained that the underlying armature for the specimen was meant for an African lion rather than a mountain lion. So it turns out that while the external features, the literal action, if you will, were right, the underlying structure, or the essential action or subtext, was all wrong, and I sensed it. I've included the picture in the show notes if you want to see exactly what I mean.
And readers sense cognitive dissonance too. You want readers to experience some cognitive dissonance. In reading your story, they're on their own worldview revelation journey, and feeling just a little bit confused will motivate them to keep reading and find out the answer. This is the narrative drive form called mystery. The cognitive dissonance you need to worry about is when a character's literal action isn't backed by a clear essential action arising from their object of desire. This is the kind of cognitive dissonance that makes your reader feel that something is fundamentally and pervasively not right, like the mountain lion skin on the African lion armature. It pulls the reader out of the experience of the story. If they can't explain the problem away, or if they don't believe a solution is forthcoming, they become bored or discouraged. They put the book down. If they do finish it, they leave a negative review and tell their friends not to read it. Cognitive dissonance arises when we mistake real life for stories and real people for characters. Unlike real humans who are chaotic, who undermine their own goals and act randomly, characters in a story must behave consistently. Stories extract meaning from randomness, and story events can appear lifelike on the surface, but underneath, an engine of essential action must propel both protagonist and antagonist through conflict toward their objects of desire. This means that as writers, we have to make choices. We have to use our imaginations. We can't just regurgitate life. That's not story. Writers must impose structure and create patterns. We build story events out of two or more characters in conflict, moving towards their objects of desire, scene by scene, according to their essential actions, until they reach an ultimate showdown where something must change. Now that is story. Author and writing instructor James Hines explains that the most important difference between fictional characters and real people is that the author can let us know exactly what a fictional character is thinking or feeling. We can know fictional characters in the way we know ourselves. In fiction, we have direct access to the consciousness of other human beings in a way we cannot in real life. He goes on, the intimacy we share with fictional characters is only the illusion of intimacy, but it's such a powerful illusion that at its best and most sublime, the book in our hands disappears, the world around us disappears, and we become fully engaged in the fictional world, at one with the character. So how do we create this intimacy? Through essential action.
So let's look at essential action in action with two examples, because some real examples will help us put this important tool right into your hand. We'll look at two pieces of client work that we were using with permission to see how nailing the essential action can snap a scene or even a whole story into crystal clear focus. First, we'll talk about my client. I suggested that my client revise a scene after offering essential action feedback. In the first version, the point of view character, a special investigator that I'll call Ted, is ordered to appear before a board of review. Ted faces no impediments along the way to his destination, but he does wonder about why the board has summoned him. It appears that his goal is to get to the bottom of something, and that's his essential action. Ted rules out a couple of possibilities, but there's no turning point, crisis, climax, or resolution that relates to this goal. We learn lots of cool details about Ted and his world, but he never resolves the question about why he's been summoned. I suggested that my client clarify the scene's overall purpose and Ted's real goal in the scene, and then make sure the five commandments were in line with Ted's essential action of getting to the bottom of something. The revised scene begins with Ted's arrival at his destination, wanting to know why he's been summoned. He tries several tactics to get to the bottom of it. He queries the board members. He entreats them. But of course, these antagonist board members have their own essential action, which is to get Ted to take a big risk, so they want to keep him in the dark. The conflict between Ted's essential action and that of the governing body leads to a page-turning crisis as they hustle, impel, and push Ted into a decision he doesn't want to make.
The screenplay of a client of mine became much more deeply moving and satisfying when she and I looked at the essential actions of a secondary character. In her screenplay, Dwayne is an elderly man who plays the mentor to the troubled teenage protagonist. He's in his early 80s, and as we find out, he recently lost his wife of more than 50 years. He lives alone in a cabin by a lake. He has a boat and a workshop, and each time we meet him, he's taking some literal action, right? Buying nails at the hardware store, maintaining his fishing gear, repairing an old toaster, tinkering with a light fixture. Now, because Dwayne's role is to speak gruff wisdom to the protagonist, his specific activities, it was easy to say they didn't matter much, right? In the real world, this sort of person might well actually tinker with little repair jobs in his workshop. Still, as I read him, he just felt like a cardboard cutout, just like an old mentor figure tinkering with stuff, just very two-dimensional. So I questioned the writer. I asked her about the essential action behind Dwayne's literal action of repairing a fishing rod or a toaster or something. Why is he doing this? The author couldn't say. Fishing does not enter into the story in any way. So we discussed giving him some less stereotyped things to do. Instead of various random quote-unquote realistic actions, how about a single project that we see him make progress on? Note the word progress there. It's like progressive as in complications, right? Something connected with his late wife, perhaps, since that was a salient feature of his character. That felt right to both of us. So in the new version, we see Dwayne performing the incremental tasks, that is, the literal actions, of landscape painting. We see him buying turpentine, cleaning brushes, watching a Bob Ross video, stretching a canvas, and starting to paint. You see the progress there, right? All of it is in devotion to his wife, who loved a particular view saturated with a particular autumn color that was already playing an important symbolic role in the story. With this simple change, Dwayne's literal actions have an essential action. It's all directed towards his late wife. He venerates her. He honors her memory. Perhaps he heals his own grief, right up until the big turning point when his essential action becomes to support and encourage the protagonist. And because we know him through the specificity of his literal actions now, the ending payoff, which was formerly just touching, becomes deeply moving and richly satisfying because it involves that important color and the finished painting, and the whole thing becomes beautifully meaningful where it couldn't have before.
Now, many writers believe their story is what they recorded in their initial draft. It feels sacred, and messing with it too much will break the magic spell. The story has told them what it wants to be, and even if it doesn't work for readers, they're afraid or don't know how to alter it in a significant way for the better. Well, you don't have to be that writer. You can follow a simple process to identify what your character wants and make them act accordingly. You can be the boss, the writer, director, creator, God, who avoids a series of events that meanders and feels off in a way that readers won't be able to enjoy. You simply ask yourself these two questions: what is literally happening in the scene, and what is the essential action of what the characters are doing in the scene? Now, if you commit to making conscious choices about your character's essential action in every scene and revise your five commandments to be consistent with it, you'll write the story that is truly in your mind and heart to tell, and one that will be satisfying to your readers. If you find you need help sorting out your essential and literal action, you can hire a StoryGrid certified editor by visiting storygrid.com/editing. And if you want to connect with Anne or me directly, links to our websites can be found in the show notes. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.